that you'll see in this passage is that he's always on the side of the downcast. He's always on the side of the brokenhearted. He's always tends to be always be on the side of the poor. If you take illustration after illustration in the Bible, he tends to come down on the side of the have-not. And I don't think that's any more apparent than when you look at the scene that we just read and then the scene which is to follow. Again, in verse 13 of Mark 10, "Then he brought little children to him that he might touch them, but they brought little children, pardon me, that they may touch him. But the disciples rebuked those who brought them. But when Jesus saw it, he was greatly displeased and said to them, 'Let the little children come to me. Do not forbid them, for of such is the kingdom of God. Assuredly, I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God as a little child will by no means enter it.' And he took them up in his arms, laid his hands on them, and blessed them. Now, as he was going out on the road, one came running and knelt before him and asked him, 'Good teacher, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life?' And Jesus said to him, 'Why do you call me good? No one is good but one, that is God. You know the commandments. Do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not bear false witness, do not defraud. Honor your father and your mother.' And he answered and said to him, 'Teacher, all these things I have kept from my youth up.' And then Jesus looked at him, loved him, and said to him, 'One thing you lack. Go your way, sell whatever you have and give it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Come, take up the cross and follow me.' But he was sad at this word and went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions." This scene is an interesting one because in the first scene, Jesus is there, and it's easy to give the disciples maybe a bad rap that they're anti-kid. I think that they're pro-Jesus more than anti-kid. Jesus is tired. He's worn out. He's been working hard. And parents begin to bring children to him to bless. That was a common thing in that day and age. If there was a rabbi or a priest, in fact, when children were of a certain age, very early in their life, 7 days for boys, 14 days for girls, they would be brought to the temple to be presented to the priest and to have a blessing pronounced on them. So they're coming to Jesus, and the disciples seem to want to help. He's tired. He's worn out. This is not a good time. So they start shooing the parents with their children away. But it says Jesus becomes displeased by that and says, "Bring the little children to me, for such are the kingdom of heaven." Then he says, essentially, if you're not like the children, you're not going to enter into the kingdom of heaven. You've got to be like a child to get into the kingdom. Now, in one sense, that's strange because in many ways you ought not want to be like a child. I mean, when somebody says you're childish, they're not giving you a compliment. When people said you're just acting like a child, that's not a compliment, that's a criticism, because there are many ways that you would not want to be like a child. So when Jesus says you ought to be like a child, there must be a very specific meaning to the term, because again, children can have some very bad traits. And it's almost as though it's an intuitive thing. For instance, one of the things children are not intuitively inclined to be is grateful. They're not. They live by the oath, it's better to receive than to give. I mean, Christmas is not about giving to them. You don't hear, if you're a parent, "Great job, Dad, I'm proud of you." I mean, if I say to my kids, "Hey," and I know what they're going to say, so it's fun to have the conversation, but "Hey, are you going to get to hear me preach today? Why don't you stay and hear Daddy preach?" It's like, "No, that's boring. That's awful. I mean, if Uncle Buck was preaching, why don't you let Uncle Buck pastor?" Really, Uncle Buck's a nut. Uncle Buck. No, I'm joking. So I gotta let that happen. But But there's no gratitude there. They don't know who feeds them. No one cares about them. You don't get thank you. You have to teach them to offer thanks. You have to stop them before they eat and say, it's time for the blessing. Because they don't tend to be intuitively grateful. They also don't intuitively seem to be selfless. It is about them. Now, in my house, we have this room, and it's a small room. Of the rooms upstairs, it's the smallest. I just thought that that could be my room. I know that was big thinking, but I've got a comfortable chair there and a TV and a couple lamps and a nice rug there. They've got a playroom downstairs, and it's twice as big as my room. They got a living room, and I don't go in there much. That's theirs. Nice fireplace, nice windows, nice, there's a little bit of architecture there. That's theirs. But I got a room. Been coming home lately, empty bottles laying around, my room, toys, my room. Log on to Netflix. They got it all fouled up. There's more princess shows on my recently watched list than westerns. I remember one old preacher said, if you got kids, you can't have nothing else. And that's about the size of it. Everything you have belongs to them. You ain't got nothing of yours if you got kids. They're not very selfless. They're very naive. And you wouldn't want to be like a kid in that way. We were talking to my older girls, 1-6, 1-8, about where they want what they want to do when they grow up, and that changes, you know, every 2 or 3 months. But Livy is going to move to England so that she can be a princess when she grows up. She doesn't understand there's complications to that dream. Ava, a little sweeter, a little sadder, still naive. We ask Ava, what do you want to be when you grow up? And she says, I'm going to be a vet and I'm going to marry a preacher. And I thought, well, now this is good. She's going to marry a preacher. Wow. And I said, why do you want to marry a preacher? And she said, because I want to live in my old house in North Carolina someday. It's a parsonage just behind the church we used to live in. She said, I'm going to have to marry a preacher who can pastor the church so I can get my old house back. There's a little complication there. She's worked out a system, but there is a sense of naivete there. Not going to work. Children are many things that you would not want to be. But I think in the context, there are some things about children that you and I very much need to be. I think one thing that you see here, and I think this will be implied in Jesus' teaching, one thing that children are is authentic. They're authentic. If they got a dirty face, they don't bother cleaning it. They're authentic. That's why children need supervision, because they will say what they're thinking. They're authentic in that way. I remember coming here to Candidate almost 3 years ago. And, you know, we're coming to this new place. You're going to be looking at us. And so how does that work? Well, the first thing we do is we recruit 2 babysitters. We have 2 kids because we know that if we come here, you're looking for something from our kids, and they have to have singular supervision. They have to be clean at all times. Their hair has to be okay at all times. There can't be stuff on their face at any time because they might end up on the platform at any time. And they'd be authentic if they got on the platform. And so we have to sort of hedge our bet on that. That's why you have to watch your kids, right? I mean, they are authentic. They will say things in the grocery store that are true, but are wildly inappropriate and embarrassing if you're the parent. They are authentic. They also don't mind being dependent. They don't. A kid has no problem with being a dependent. I mean, try it next year when you do your taxes. Sit them down there and say, now listen, I just want to explain to you what's going on here. I want to get your feelings on this. The government, who wants to get every dollar of mine that they can reasonably get, looks at my situation being your parent and feels sorry for me and says, we want as much money of yours as we can get. However, because you're such a sad sap and people are bleeding you dry, we are willing to give some of that money back to you as a dependent credit. You don't bring anything to this family. I just want you to know that your income is zero. Everything here is paid for by me. That makes you a dependent of mine. How does that make you feel? I mean, if they're five, that doesn't make them feel anything. They might not feel anything if they're 15 about that. They might not feel anything about that if they're 25, depending on who they are. They don't care about being a dependent. It doesn't bother their day. It doesn't mess with their week. It's just something else that they don't mind having have happen. So they don't mind being a dependent. They are authentic. And they anticipate being accepted. They anticipate being accepted. Isn't that what makes kids so great? Really? This anticipation of being accepted. I mean, listen, I can't lay down in the floor of the house without getting ridden. I'm laying there, I'm sleeping, the first one by mounts up and wants a ride around the couch. It never crosses their mind that I might not want to be ridden like a horse, that might be something that a person, you know, might feel uncomfortable with. I got a king-size bed. Doesn't cross their mind. I have a king-size bed because I like space when I sleep. They think I've got a king-size bed to sleep five people. They don't mind. But isn't it that just the almost a naivety about being accepted that endears them, because you're sitting there on your couch and they come and they just climb into your lap. Never dawns on them you might not want your lap sitting. They just anticipate being accepted into your life. Whatever you're doing, they're willing to help. You're eating something, they just come and stand there like a dog. It never crosses their mind that you wouldn't want to share what you have with them. And there is this anticipation of being accepted. They're authentic. They don't mind being dependent. They are willing and open to come and receive from you. And it seems to me that's what Jesus is getting at, because of what follows. In the synoptic gospels, their historians, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which is not a synoptic, but Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they are historians, but they're also theologians. And so sometimes they'll group the stories in a particular way to make a point. And what's interesting is that they all tell this account of Jesus with the children, but they all couple it, or they all follow it with this account of the rich young ruler who comes to Jesus. And it seems to me those two accounts go together, because in one sense, the children tell you how to come. In another sense, the rich young ruler tells you exactly how not to come. And how does he come? Well, you hear that. He comes and he's not authentic, because he says, what do I lack? I do a lot, I keep all the commandments, but I just feel like there's a chance that I might be lacking something. Can you see anything I might be lacking? And that, of course, encourages Jesus to say, there's none good. There's none good. But he comes and he's got his face cleaned. He's got his spiritual face cleaned. He doesn't come and say, my life is unmanageable. He's coming and saying, my life is really put together. There might be something that I'm lacking. But that's not authentic. That's not where any human being is. No human being is really put together like that. We might want to fake it, but that's because we're cleaning our spiritual faces. Nobody is really like that. He comes to Jesus dressed up, inauthentic. And he comes to Jesus, and he doesn't want to be a dependent of Jesus, because he says, when they get through there, he says, well, what can I do? What can I do? What do I lack? Is there anything that I can do? Is there anything that I'm lacking? I think that's the connotation. He doesn't want to get into a situation or a conversation with Jesus where he's powerless, where there's nothing that he can bring. He's bringing his righteousness, and out of that righteousness, he expects something from God. I don't think he's approaching God saying, I have absolutely nothing, and if I'm going to be right with God, you're going to have to do everything. I'm going to have to be completely dependent on you. That's not what he's thinking. He's coming and saying, what can I do? I'm sure there's something that I can do. What can I do? He's sort of like the prodigal son, isn't he? As a prodigal son, Luke 15, he goes to the far country, he wastes his dad's money, and then he's in the pig pen, he's got nothing, and it dawns on him, he says, the hired servants in my father's house, they've got more than I do, I'm going to go back and ask my dad for a job. It's really strange that he says that because there were actually very few hired servants in that culture. Most of them were slaves. Why doesn't he say, I'm going to go back and be a slave to my dad? That's better than what I'm doing now. No, he says, I'm going to go back and try to get a job from my dad. And I think the reason he wants a job is there's maybe a notion in his mind that says, if I work hard enough and save enough money, I'll be able to pay my dad back someday. Of course, he can't do that. Nothing that he can do to pay his dad back. He didn't break a law. He broke a heart. And the money that he would make would be a pale pittance to what he could earn to pay his father back. But that is something that humans often do. I was talking to a guy a while back, and he's a smart guy, and he's an honest guy. And he said, Christians like to talk about how great grace is. He said, I think grace is a terrible thing. He said, because in every other aspect of my life, I have leverage. In my businesses, I have leverage. I'm able to sit down, and the conversations that I have are these. I want you to do something for me, and this is what I can do for you. It's a trading. Even to some degree in my family, I do things for them, they do things for me. He said, I like to be at the table with leverage. But when you talk about grace, what that means is that I'm at the table with God, and I have absolutely no leverage with Him. Oftentimes, as adults, right, we like the leverage. And we don't want to be dependent. And this guy doesn't. And then thirdly, I don't think he anticipates being accepted by Jesus. I think that's the issue. I really do. I think he's coming, and in some ways there's a defensiveness about him. He's got his righteousness in line. His spiritual face is clean. He's worked it out. He's coming to Jesus, and he thinks, if I come across right, then he'll accept me. But I've got to say the right thing. I've got to do the right thing. And then he's going to accept me. I don't think that he anticipates like a child just being accepted. I don't think he can go throw himself on the lap of Jesus, so to speak, and think that Jesus will put his arms around him. And so he doesn't expect to be accepted. And you know what? It is vitally important that you understand that Jesus Christ will accept you. That's why Judas hangs himself. That's why Peter makes it right. Judas betrays Jesus. And out of, I think, sheer guilt and torture for what he did, he goes out and hangs himself before he ever has a conversation with Jesus. But Peter denies Jesus. He's there in the courtyard. Jesus is suffering. He's got the trial. Everything's going on. The passion of Jesus is starting, I should say. And Peter's out there. People start to say, you're one of them, you serve him, you're a disciple. Peter swears in that moment, and it's just not a swearing, it's an anathema, which means the swearing has to have a target the way it's set up. So Peter is either saying, may I be something, insert vulgar word there, if I'm one of his disciples, or he's saying, he is a something. I'm telling you, I'm not one of his disciples. He is blank. It has to have a target. And it's very possible in that moment, Peter swears, not just swears, but curses Jesus to get out of that mess that he's in. And then he doesn't see Jesus. And maybe what Judas did is a little worse than Peter, but they both failed miserably when it counted. Judas hangs himself. But it's interesting because the disciples are in a boat. Jesus has been crucified. They're in this boat. There's a guy on the shore who yells out, "Do you have anything to eat?" Which means, "Have you caught anything?" And they yell back that they haven't caught anything. And the figure, shadowy figure on the shore, yells out, "Well, why don't you throw your nets on the other side?" And that triggers a memory in Peter, because the first time he met Jesus is in his boat. Jesus asks if he can use his boat to do some preaching to people on the shore. After he's through preaching, they go out to sea, or Jesus says, "Let's go out to sea." And Peter said, "I've fished all night. We didn't catch a thing." Jesus says, "Well, let's go on out and see what we can do." And it says that they throw the nets where Jesus tells them, and the nets begin to break because there's so much fish. And so I think that triggers Peter. Oh, it's Jesus. He's telling me where to fish again. And you know what Peter does? Now, the last time that he seen Jesus, he betrayed him. And if that's me, I'm thinking, oh, I'm getting in the back of the boat. The boat's going up to the shore. And I'm sort of getting out of the boat saying, "Sorry. Sorry about all that. I really fouled that. I messed that up." That's what I'm doing. But it says Peter throws off his coat when he knows it's Jesus. He jumps in the water and he swims to the shore. Now, he's a kid. Only a kid, only a male child would deny a man, would say, "I don't know the man," would fail him when he needed him most. And when he sees him, jump out of the boat and just swim to him to be embraced. Only a kid would do something like that. But he expected to be accepted. What's interesting is that that first moment that Peter saw him, 3 years before, all the fish come in and they see that Jesus is right, that he's the Lord of the sea. Peter falls down and says, "Depart from me. I'm a sinner." He says, "Get away from me." But now in this scene, he jumps out of the boat and he swims to him like a kid. You know what he knows? He knows that Jesus is approachable, that he will accept you if you come to him. He didn't know that in the beginning, but being with Jesus, he figured that out. He found it out for himself. And if you want to come to Jesus today, if you come with your righteous record, with your face clean, inauthentic, if you come not wanting to be dependent on Him for every spiritual and physical need, if you come wondering and doubting whether He will accept you, you know what? You won't be accepted. This guy walks away and he's sorrowful. But if you come as the kid, bring it all to Him. All your stuff, you know what? Everything you've done, He knows about. Every thought you've had, He knows about. He knows the dirt. He knows the stuff in there. And while you were yet a sinner, He died for you. You might as well come authentically. You might as well come like a kid. And you might as well come expecting to be a dependent, because there is nothing that I can do or you can do to save yourself. It's all going to have to be done by Him. It's all what He did on Calvary. And if that's not enough, there's nothing else we can do. We are entirely spiritually dependent on Him for every good thing. You might as well know you're going to end up on His tax return. You can be His dependent. But come anyway. Come knowing that He will accept you. Come knowing that your Heavenly Father is a Father that loves you. And if you get out of the pig pen, as that young guy did, wherever you're at, maybe you're not in a pig pen, but this guy was in a pig pen. And if you'll go home, your Father will come and He will throw His arms around you and He will embrace you. He will accept you. And if you come as a child, your life can be changed. If you come as an adult, dignified, something to give, worried whether you'll be accepted, you'll be rejected. If you'll come as a kid, you'll be accepted. So come. Come. Bring it all. Bring it all. Bring the hurts, habits, bring the hang-ups. Bring it all. Don't hide it. He knows about it anyway. Come broken. Come dependent. Come expecting that He will accept you, and He will. He will. Will you stand with me?